The God of the Old Testament is arguably the most unpleasant character in all fiction. Jealous and proud of it. A petty, unjust, unforgiving control freak. A vindictive, bloodthirsty ethnic cleanser. A misogynistic, homophobic, racist, infanticidal, genocidal, filicidal, pestilential, megalomaniacal, sadomasochistic, capriciously malevolent bully.
Is it true? Is the God of the Bible a moral monster? And if he's not, how do we address the charges that are being made by atheists today?
One of the things I'm excited about this short four-week class is our opportunity to make sense of the Old Testament God. Charges have been brought against him regarding the Canaanite genocide, or slavery, or polygamy, or concubinage, a number of issues found in the Old Testament that we'll be able to touch on in this class.
You and I talked about the college professor I ran into at Easy Mart. That guy just pummeled me with statements about the Old Testament. And if I just had some basic tactics, I could have just taken a couple steps back and would have had a completely different experience.
Yeah, wouldn't it have been great to be able to turn the tables on him without becoming debative or combative?
Yeah, you know, here's a guy who makes a statement and then expects me to prove something that he owns the burden of proof for. I'm hoping we can equip some people to where they can just, they can have a solid understanding of how to combat these things and, quite frankly, make it safe for them and give them a good learning environment.
Absolutely. We won't answer all the questions, but I bet we stir the pot. We're going to have fun with this class. I'm really looking forward to it.
All right, I'm going to sign up. be good to have you. We'll be doing our thing here and all that. Work the way back there, Ronnie, behind you, and then get the baskets back to the booth. We'd love to have you do that for us as we all turn to page 85. All right, we are in session 4 of Panorama Plus 2. We are taking the second movement of 12. A panorama of the Bible, and we're driving down six lessons or six sessions in order to cover the life of the four patriarchs, Abraham, Isaac, Jacob, and Joseph as well. On page 85 in the workbook, that's where we are, you'll notice we have the panorama timeline for movement 2. It's given to you or for you there with Abraham, Isaac, Jacob, and Joseph as man of faith, man of peace, man of cunning. Notice Jacob, whose name will change to Israel. He's the man of cunning or the man of deception. That's where we are today. We're going to be looking at the life of Jacob. On the next page, on page 86, at the top of the page, we have the horizontal chart, which once again shows us the panorama timeline for movement 2. Abraham, Isaac, Jacob. And we've shaded the Jacob box because we're going to be looking at chapters 27 through about 35 or 6, somewhere along in there. Also, you'll notice that we have a chart, an extended chart, on the life of Jacob. If you go back later and you read through some of the notes, or if you ever want to do a study in the life of Jacob, I would encourage you to take this because not only does it have the thematic flow of what's happening in Jacob's life, it also has the geographical flow. And this is very important for us in order to understand the things that Jacob is going through. He is in the Messianic promise line, the Abrahamic covenant, which has been so incredibly important to Abraham, passed on to Isaac, is now going to be passed on to Jacob, not to his brother Esau, the elder brother, but it will be passed on to Jacob. So all of this flight outside of the land to get a wife and to escape his brother's wrath and also coming back into the land, all of this is important under the umbrella of the Abrahamic covenant, that God promises land, God promises descendants, and God promises a unique blessing. Now, today we have so much material to cover, and I just tried to cover it at 9:30, so I know we got to move faster than warp factor 5. So what I'm going to ask you to do is look on the bottom of page 87, where it says theft of blessing. That's where we're starting in Genesis 27 and 8. This event, this theft of the blessing, he's already stolen his birthright, if you'll recall that from last time. Right now, we're seeing the strife continue between the twin brothers. They were fighting in the womb. As Esau was being born first, the other twin, Jacob, grabbed him by the ankle. They're fighting over the birthright. They're going to be fighting over the blessing, the binding prophetic blessing that the Father would give to the sons. And this is just going to capture us as we go through this story. Let's go ahead and get to it, top of page 88, with Genesis 27, verse 1. When Isaac was old and his eyes were so weak that he could no longer see. Now, let's be honest. He cannot see physically, but he is also blind emotionally as well. He doesn't see the forces that are ripping his own family apart. This man is fully, completely blind, physically and emotionally as well. He could no longer see, so he calls for Esau. Now, why does he want Esau to come? Because Isaac favors Esau, and he wants to extend to him the covenantal, not the covenantal, but the patriarchal blessing of the father to the son. It would have been an oath-like blessing that would have been binding, irrevocable, and because he is in the family of God, it is going to be prophetic. It will be fulfilled. So he wants to bless Esau, even though prophecy had already said that the older would serve the younger, that the younger is actually going to be of the messianic line. Isaac's going to try to circumvent that and give the blessing to the older son. So he says to him in verse 4, prepare for me the kind of tasty food I like. Isaac is driven by his passion for food. Esau, the hunter, is driven by his passion for food and things as well. So he says, go prepare, get great hunter, I want you to go and find the tasty food, prepare it for me, so that I may give you my blessing before I die. We know from ancient records that we have uncovered that the blessing was legally enforceable by ancient Near Eastern law. So it's legally binding. But not only that, it's prophetically binding because God is going to honor the blessings of the patriarchs, as we will see as we unfold the rest of the book of Genesis. You'll notice point A there that I have indicated that Isaac is 100 years old and he's blind and uncertain how long he will live. Give me a break. He's going to live 80 more years. He's going to die at 180, but he thinks he's on his last leg. He's just about to go. And so so he's being driven by his appetites. He wants Esau to take care of him. Point C at the bottom. Isaac and Esau apparently believe that the birthright and the blessing are separate. Now, that's not that doesn't appear to be the conclusion of the New Testament writer in Hebrews, although it could be that the writer of the Hebrews just simply sees both of those as like the head and tail of one coin and sees them together. Isaac and Esau see them as separate because the birthright is what one was due from the father's possessions. And the father would give later on, historically, the first son would get a double portion. Every other son would get a proportionate portion of the blessings, the material blessings that the father had. Esau has already sold his birthright, his what's due from his father's possessions. He's already sold that for a pot of stew. And so now the question is, what about the blessing? The blessing is what is promised and predicted for the rest of one's life. What kind of life will I have? Will I be a blessed man? Will I be a super abundantly blessed man? Now we're concerned about the patriarchal blessing. At the top of page 89, we find out that Rebekah is listening in. Now, Rebekah is from the family of Laban, which we will interact with him a little bit later. That's her brother. Rebekah and that whole family are a bunch of deceivers. No wonder Jacob seems to have this whole family trait. She's kind of sneakily listening in to Esau talking to, Isaac talking to Esau. So she's listening in. It's sort of reminiscent of Sarah when she was listening at the tent flap when the three visitors came that were angels on their way to do the Sodom and Gomorrah event. And so she's listening in and hearing about this. And what we're going to discover, point B on this page, is this is one dysfunctional family. Rebekah urges her son. In fact, three times in the story, she'll say, obey me. Do what I tell you to do. She is a perfect example not of trust and obey. She's a perfect example of trust and manipulate. She's going to help things out a little bit, and she's going to tell her compliant son, Jacob, you just do what I tell you, and we're going to set this thing right. Your father's trying to give the blessing to your brother, but we're going to figure this out. So she says, I'm going to prepare some food, and I want you to take it to your father under the guise of being Esau. He's blind. He won't know. So that he can give you the blessing. So not only will you steal the birthright, you can now steal the blessing. What a family. Notice point one, the blessings in the patriarchal period were given at significant departures. For example, imminent death, and that's what Isaac thinks he's at the verge of. The blessing was binding. And so consequently, at point two at the bottom, Rebekah's failure is in the deception of her husband. She treasures the Abrahamic covenant and she treasures the patriarchal blessing. But she should have trusted in God and allowed things to happen according to God's timing. But she said, oh no, I've got to get in there. And so I'll have to deceive my husband and we'll deceive my son's brother and we will get this thing by human ingenuity and deception rather than by full and complete trust in God. She should have acted in such a way as to trusted God to act in a timely manner. Instead, she's acting in a sinful manner. The bottom of page 89, the biblical text. Verse 11, Jacob said to Rebekah, his mother. He understands. He clearly realizes the jeopardy he's putting himself in, the risk. He said, but my brother Esau is a hairy man, and I have smooth skin. What if my father touches me? I would appear to be tricking him. That Hebrew word really has the idea of mocking. It's the same word that is used when the children of Israel would mock the prophets who would come and bring God's message, and they would not listen to it, they would not obey it, but they would mock. It carries that, I would appear to be mocking my father, ridiculing him by this deception. And I would bring down not a blessing, but I would get a curse out of this. Verse 13, his mother said to him, let the curse fall on me. You do what you're told. You obey me. Do what I'm telling you to do. Next page. Jacob is a realist. He understands, if this doesn't work, I'm in deep trouble. Next point, Rebekah counters, I'm willing to take the curse. You just do what you're supposed to do. So Rebekah prepares the food, just the way Esau would have prepared it. Rebekah dresses Jacob in Esau's clothes. And not only that, she covers his smooth skin with goat's hair so that Jacob smells and feels like his brother. Now remember, Isaac is blind. And so he's going to, when Jacob shows up, he's going to smell like and feel like Esau. But one thing he can't change, he talks like Jacob. He doesn't talk like Esau. Doesn't have his son's voice. And Isaac later is going to say, well, he smells and feels like my son Esau, but he talks like Jacob. Well, that's because he is Jacob. Blind at the middle of the page, 27:21, Isaac said to Jacob, dressed up in the ruse, come near so I can touch you, my son, to know whether you're really my son Esau. He wants to verify the identity because the voice is the voice of Jacob, but the hands are the hands of Esau. He's confused. Isaac's confused. And he says, are you really my son Esau? And after Jacob lies, after all, he's the deceiver. He's the supplanter. His life is built upon deception. And he purports to be Esau. Isaac desires to eat and then give him his blessing. And the top of page 91, there's a significant thing that happens, and we're going to follow it throughout the story. So Jacob, in the guise of Esau, went to his father Isaac, and he kissed him. In doing so, we think in these times, the kissing is the kissing of affection. It's the kiss of warmth and fellowship within a family, of goodwill. All of these things are associated with the custom of kissing the father. It shows compliance and all of these kind of things. But this is a kiss of deception. And now you think in your mind, what about all the kisses of deception that we find throughout the scripture, even leading to the Garden of Gethsemane, where Judas Iscariot greets Jesus with a kiss and so forth. Well, Jacob kisses his father, the ultimate slam of this deception. And when Isaac caught the smell of his clothes, the smell of his body and so forth, he says, this is my son. Verse 28, may God give you, and then he blesses him. May nations serve you. May the sons of your mother bow down to you. May those who curse you be cursed, those who bless you be blessed. That's very reminiscent of Genesis 12:3, the call of Abraham, that those who bless you, I'll bless. Those who curse you, I will curse. And so he gives this blessing in the form of an oracle or in the form of a prophetic prediction. It's binding, it's irrevocable, and it has the flavor of Abrahamic covenant blessing all about it. This renewal, point C towards the bottom, this renewal and reaffirmation of the covenantal promises follow the lineage of Jacob. Jacob is the seed of the woman, not Esau the eldest. Verse 30, after Isaac finished blessing him, and Jacob had scarcely left his father's presence. And now you wish you'd been there. Because what you got this elaborate deception, but Esau's coming back, and just as he leaves, Esau shows up, and you see the drama of the moment. Isaac realizes that Esau's brother has taken the irrevocable blessing, and now what are we going to do? Turn the page. Verse 36 at the top, Esau said, isn't he rightly named supplanter or deceiver? This is the second time he's taken advantage of me. I mean, now give me a break on this one. The first time you were so hungry, you said, give me some of that stew. Well, I will if you'll sell me your birthright. Sure, no, who needs a birthright when you're hungry? And so now he's feigning. Oh, he's just really duped me two different times. Well, okay. He took my birthright. Now he's taking my blessing. And then he, in a pitiful sort of way, he says, haven't you reserved any blessing for me? One writer says he's willing even now to take the crumbs. Is there anything left in all of this? Verse 39, Isaac answered his son, your dwelling, here's your blessing, your dwelling will be away from the earth's richness. You're going to be out in the wilderness, not in the lush valleys. You will live by the sword. You're going to be a man of warfare of all your life. You will begin by serving your brother, but later you will overthrow that yoke. In other words, you, Esau, the father of the Edomites, you are going to live out in the wilderness, be a warlike people, and you will always be in enmity and strife against your brother, Jacob, or the Israelites. And that actually became true in Israelite history. It was fulfilled in later scripture. At the top of page 93... Well, I'll tell you what, let's go back to page 92 at the bottom. Genesis 27:41. Esau held a grudge. That Hebrew word speaks of deep-seated anger that leads to violent retaliation. In other words, this isn't a grudge of, well, I just don't like you anymore, and that's just not fair. And it's not that kind of grudge. This is the kind of grudge where he sets his jaw and he says, I'm not going to get back. I'm not even going to get even. I'm going to get more than even. And his grudge has a violent retaliation. As a matter of fact, he says to himself, the days of mourning for my father are near. Well, at least he thought they were. Then when my father dies, here's what I'll do. You just wait, Jacob. I'm going to kill my brother. I'm going to kill him. Stole my birthright. Stole my blessing. So when dad's gone, and I don't have to worry about that problem, the father's anger and so forth, I will kill him. So Rebekah intervenes, and she urges Jacob to flee to her family all the way back up in the north in the area of Paddan Aram, the top of the Fertile Crescent, up in what is now today modern-day southern Turkey. On the right-hand side, on page 93, the scripture reads, then Rebekah said to Isaac. Now, here's her problem. Her problem is, how do I get Jacob out of harm's way? Because I can't just on my own send him off. I mean, I'm not the patriarchal head. So how do I get Jacob out of harm's way? So she's got to provide a good cover story to get him out of town. And so she said to Isaac, I'm disgusted with living because of these Hittite women, Esau's wives. Esau had gone out and married not within the relatives, as he should have done, according to the plan of his parents. He just went out and took some Hittite, Canaanite women as his brides. And Rebekah said to Isaac, I'm disgusted with living. I mean, you've got a Jewish mother just giving it what for to the husband. If Jacob takes a wife from the women of this land and the Hittite women like this, well, my life will just not be worth living. I mean, you can just hear it. I mean, it's just resonating in this. And so this is the cover story, is we need to send Jacob off to get a wife from our relatives, much like your father did for you Isaac. He sent his servant Eleazar. Eleazar found me. I came back and so forth. I want to do the same thing for Jacob because I can't have any more of these Canaanite, Hittite women in here. Now, point two at the top of 93 needs to be corrected. There is a word left out that changes the meaning, and we got to get the right meaning. Isaac blesses Jacob in this departure and commands him not to marry a Canaanite woman. The word not is missing, so that you need to add that in. Isaac blesses Jacob, commands him not to marry a Canaanite woman, and sends him north. Chapter 28, verse 3, this is the blessing that Isaac sends him off on as he departs. May God Almighty, El Shaddai, bless you materially and make you fruitful with descendants. Verse 4, may he give you and your descendants the blessing given to Abraham. So he sends him out and say, you're leaving the covenant land, the promised land, but only for a short period of time. Then you will come back and may God bless you richly according to all of the Abrahamic covenant aspects. And so let's look at the bottom of page 93. Note the response of Esau. He then goes out and marries. He finds out, oh, my brother's going off to get a wife. Well, I'll just marry some Ishmaelite women. He gets two more brides. And what we see, a summary of what he has done. Esau has, number one, despised his birthright. Two, he lost the preferred blessing, as his father blessed his brother instead of himself. He then married foreign women, and then he's marrying again, only this time it's somewhat in the family. These are descendants of Ishmael. He's a marginalized family member who deeply wants to belong, but he never treasures what's really important. He's hungry. He wants a bowl of stew. He'll trade his birthright. He never treasures what's really most important. I want wives of the family, like my father and my mother. No, I'll just marry these Hittite women. He doesn't value the things that are most important, but he wants to be accepted so bad within the family. He is a man driven by his own appetites and his own flesh and his own wants rather than being driven by a higher or nobler cause. Top of page 94, we have Jacob on his way to Paddan Aram, about 400 miles from Beersheba. So Jacob, in Genesis 28:10, leaves Beersheba in obedience to his father and mother, and he sets out for Haran. When he reached a certain place, literally in the Hebrew, when he reaches the place, a very special place, stops for the night, the sun had set, and he took a stone there and put it under his head. Now, that may be strange to you because I can't sleep on a stone pillow. But actually, they have found documents, ancient documents that document that this is really, they used hard surfaces for their head. We need soft pillows. They had hard surfaces. So at any rate, nonetheless, he takes a rock, slides it under his head, and lays down to sleep. Verse 12, he has the dream. And if you grew up in Sunday school and flannel graphs, you saw Jacob's ladder. Well, here's Jacob's ladder, though it's not a ladder. It's really more like a stairway. He saw a dream of a stairway resting on the earth, top reaches into heaven, and the angels of God were ascending and descending on Jacob's ladder, on the stairway, if you will. Verse 13, it says that there above it stood the Lord, and the Lord said, I am. Remember, that's foreshadowing the divine name, I am that I am. I am the Lord, the God of the father of Abraham, God of Isaac. I will give you and your descendants, and now we have the land, the descendants, the blessing aspects of the Abrahamic covenant. God is meeting in a revelatory dream. He is meeting Jacob, and he is awakening in Jacob a very infant, small faith that must grow. Jacob cannot live by the faith of his father, Abraham. Jacob cannot live by the, of his grandfather, Abraham. Jacob cannot live by the faith of his father, Isaac. Jacob needs his own faith in order to be the patriarchal father of the 12 tribes of Israel, of which he will be the father of. He needs his personal encounter with God. And this is the first revelation of God personally to Jacob. In this revelation, God is taking all of the initiative. There's no scheming by Jacob. He hasn't done anything to try to manipulate it. He has simply had a vision, and God has met him. And in doing so, he's still Jacob. He's still a conniver. He's still deceptive, but he is now has an infant faith that is beginning to grow and develop. And we're going to watch the story. It will climax when he has to prepare himself to meet his brother in 20 years. Because his brother's going to come to meet him when he returns to the land. On the next page, I've given you a little New Testament insight on that stairway. I'll allow you to read that. We don't have time to go into it, but there's some nice New Testament parallels to the stairway, even in the New Testament. God made some promises, top of page 96. He made four promises to Jacob. And here are what those promises are, and look how important they are. God said to him, I'm with you. That's God's presence. He said, I'll watch over you. That's God's protection. He said, I will bring you back to this land. That's God's promise. And he says, I will not leave you. That is God's faithfulness. Those are the very things that this man is going to need in order to become the patriarchal father of the children of Israel. And so God's presence, his protection, his promise, and his faithfulness will follow Jacob all the way to Paddan Aram as he will meet his future wife. Verse 16, when Jacob awoke from his sleep, he thought, the Lord is in this place, and I was not aware of it. He was afraid, and he said, how awesome is this place? From a Hebrew word meaning fear and awe. How awesome is this place? Fearsome is this place. This is none other than the house of God, the gate of heaven. His faith has awakened. Now, at the top of the next page, he is going to make a vow. And in making his vow, if God will fulfill his promise, presence, protection, promise, faithfulness, if God will do his part, he vows to return. And this is what he said. Number one, the Lord, you will be my God. I'll not serve any other gods. He lived in a polytheistic culture. All the other civilizations were polytheistic. He says, no, you alone will be my God. Secondly, that stone pillar that I laid my head upon will become the foundation for an altar, recognizing this as a holy place, the place where I met with you. And thirdly, I'll give you one-tenth of my blessings. Now, right now, you need to understand, he doesn't have a wife, he doesn't have flocks, he doesn't have herds, he doesn't have anything. And so he is promising in the future, God, as if you keep your promise and do all the things you said you'd do for me, I'll give you one-tenth of all the blessings that you provide for me. A way of saying, I acknowledge by giving back to you, I acknowledge that it's through your hands that I've been blessed. That is a foundational principle, by the way, for New Testament giving as well, is we acknowledge that what we have is a provision of God and we give back a portion to indicate that we're not shackled by the chains of materialism. This also recalls what Abraham did when Melchizedek, the king of Salem, the king of Jerusalem, if you will, before there was a Jerusalem, the king of Salem came out, and Abraham had just won a battle over that confederation of kings, and when the king of Salem came out, he gave him one-tenth as a priest of the true God, gave him one-tenth of the spoil that he had taken. And so consequently, there's a flavor of that as well. All right, chapter 29, middle of the page 97, we arrive at Paddan Aram. Verse 1 says, then Jacob continued from Bethel on his journey to Paddan Aram and came to that land, which makes us, the readers of the story, ask the question, okay, now what's going to happen? What's going to happen next? Well, what's going to happen is he's going to see some shepherds, and those shepherds are near a well, and they're watering their flock. And there's this, in the background, is this sounds a lot like when Abraham sent his servant to find a wife for my father. There's some similarities here. And so he asked these shepherds, do you know Laban? They said, well, sure, we know Laban. In fact, coincidence, well, there's his daughter, Rachel, coming right now. And here you have a biblical example of what we call coincidences. Or better, the hidden hand of God, or the providential hand of God in orchestrating events in order that things happen as they should. This is a providential defining moment. And so when Jacob, top of the next page, when Jacob saw Rachel, the daughter of his uncle Laban, and Laban's sheep, he went over and rolled the stone away from the mouth of the well, and watered his uncle's sheep. Now, the text tells us that it usually took several shepherds to move the stone. Jacob moves it by himself. which is part of the reason why Jewish tradition said he was a giant and a very, very strong man. Now, that's Jewish tradition. The text just simply says he does this. He's overcome with emotion. He's traveled 400 miles, and lo and behold, coincidence of coincidences, he has met the daughter of his uncle Laban. He has gone to seek out his uncle and that family in order to find a bride. And so when he sees her, verse 11, Jacob kisses Rachel, and he begins to weep aloud. I want us to contrast how Jacob did to contrasted to Eleazar, if it was Eleazar, the servant of Abraham. If you recall the story last week, the servant of Abraham, that servant, and I think it was Eleazar, when he providentially met Rebecca and all that, he just praises God. He tells, gives God all the glory and so forth. And so what you have is, you have the pious, godly servant of Abraham who found Rebecca and worshiped the Lord. And now when Jacob meets Rachel, he flexes his muscles. I mean, that's the kind of person that he is. There is no faith. There is, oh, God, you have brought me to the right place. No worshiping and all that. He just basically takes a couple of poses and moves the rock and impresses her with his strength. The point being, his strength of faith needs to catch up with his strength of body. This man is a man on a faith journey, like many of us are on a faith journey. And his faith needs to be like a muscle. His faith needs to be stretched. His faith needs to be exercised in order that it gets stronger and stronger and stronger. And so we have a contrast between his physical strength and his lack of completed full spiritual strength. Well, what does Rachel do? Well, she takes off to tell her father. Laban, by this time, is probably the sole male survivor of the Nahor-Bethuel clan group. So verse 13 at the bottom of page 98 says, as soon as Laban heard the news about Jacob, his sister's son, he hurried to meet him. The last time he met a group of people coming from the south, they had 10 camels full of goodies and some bridal gifts and all of that kind of stuff. And so here's Laban saying, oh, I wonder what we're going to have this time. So he hurries to meet him, and he kisses him, brings him to his home, and Jacob then tells him about all that's been going on. I doubt if he told him about the deception. I think he told him more about the Bethel thing, that God has been following me, and God has brought me to this place. And Laban says, oh, well, you're my own flesh and blood, and so forth. And so the text tells us that he embraced and kissed Jacob. And now we got that kissing thing again. This is a kiss. This kiss will seem in the future, in light of the way Laban's going to treat Jacob later, this kiss is going to appear to be a sham full of hypocrisy. Yeah, he's kissing him today, and he's deceiving him and robbing him tomorrow. And so we're seeing this deceptive kissing motif going on. And there's probably a principle there for us in the New Testament living. Let's have less kissing and hugging, and let's move on from there. All right. What is Laban thinking? Well, I think Laban is a greedy man. He's thinking, hey, I got lavish gifts before when Rebecca was taken as a bride. What am I going to get if my daughter is taken as a bride? And so consequently, when we get down to the bottom of page 99, Genesis 29:14. The story continues after Jacob had stayed with him for a whole month, the arrival and the formal end to his journey, and he's staying there. Laban said to him, just because you're a relative of mine, should you work for nothing? In other words, you're not a servant. You're not an indentured servant. You're certainly not a hired hand. So tell me, what are your wages going to be? That word wages, work, payment, that is a theme that drives the relationship between Laban and Jacob. They're going to be fighting over money, fighting over possessions through their entire 20 years together. But it's going to, on the surface, he said, well, hey, what do I need to pay you? You know, you're not a servant and so forth. Now, Laban had two daughters. The name of the older was Leah, and the name of the younger was Rachel. We don't know what the word Leah in Hebrew actually means. In Akkadian, it means cow. In Arabic, it means wild cow. And I'll just leave it at that. Rachel means ewe, in other words, lamb or sheep. which vocationally is appropriate because she was a shepherdess. And so Leah is the older, Rachel is the younger. Leah, verse 17, had weak eyes, but Rachel had a lovely figure and was beautiful. Duh, which one do you think Jacob's going to choose? Weak eyes or beautiful in form and lovely figure and beautiful? Well, he says, Jacob was in love, romantically or physically attracted to Rachel. He says, I'll work with you 7 years, a very generous amount, 7 years. I don't have bridal payment to give you for this bride, but I'll work for you for 7 years, and that'll be my bridal payment. And a very generous thing. And so Laban agrees. And so as we turn the page, top of page 100, we acknowledge that the older sister, Leah, is described as having weak eyes. Now, think of it, if you would. In those days, they would wear a full robe. A woman would wear often a turban-type covering over the top of their head, and they would wear a veil. So what's the only thing you would see? The eyes. And so in ancient Near East, they valued sparkling eyes. I married a lady with sparkling eyes. Sometimes they flash with anger, but sometimes they flash with joy and merriment and so forth and all those things. And so that was highly valued in the ancient Near East, having bright and sparkly eyes. And so some believe that weak eyes here simply means she had no sparkle in her eyes. Others believe that, no, it was probably that she had poor eyesight. She didn't see very well. And you can't go to the ophthalmologist and take care of business that way. She couldn't see real well. I got a sneaky suspicion that it means that weak-eyed, that whenever you looked at her, your knees would buckle because she wasn't very nice-looking. But that's another story. All right, some suggest maybe it was the vision. Rachel, on the other hand, is lovely in form and beautiful. On the surface, there is no comparison. So we're not surprised that Jacob wants Rachel. Laban agrees to it. The text is silent. We don't know what Rachel, we don't know what Leah are thinking. They are never quoted in the story. And so he worked 7 years. In fact, chapter 21, verse 20 says, Jacob served 7 years to get Rachel, but they seemed like only a few days to him because of his love for her. But at the end of the 7 years, it's over. The waiting is over. Chapter 29, verse 21, Jacob said to Laban, and this is an imperative in the Hebrew language, give me, it's like a command, give me my wife, meaning this is a binding betrothal. There would also, as a part of this marriage ceremony, which would last about a week, there would be a feast. And at that feast, the wine would flow. It became a drinking feast. And this may explain a part of the reason why the next morning when Jacob wakes up, it's not Rachel next to him, it's Leah. And sometimes we think, how could he not know the difference? Well, think of it this way. It's a drinking feast, so he's tipsy. Maybe he's just a bit tight. And not only that, she's wearing the veil, wearing the hat, and so forth. And he doesn't recognize the eyes being the eyes of Leah, but he sees them as his, for 7 years he's been waiting, he sees the eyes of Rachel in his mind. And so when they're escorted to the bridal chamber, that explains why he would never know until the next morning. The text is silent as to what his first words were. I'll leave that for your imagination. What happens as a result of this is he goes to Laban and he says, what have you done to me? And Laban said, oh, well, you know, there's a custom. We marry our older before we marry the younger. And so he says, but if you'll work seven more years, then you can have Rachel as well. Not 7 years and then get Rachel, but if you agree to this, you work for me 7 more years. When your week of your wedding is over, then you can have the second wife. You can have Rachel. And so verse 30 says that Jacob agreed. He made love to Rachel, and his love for Rachel was greater than his love for Leah. The soil of bitter jealousy and rivalry in that household. But he has to work 7 more years. Look at the bottom of page 101.3. Laban has shamelessly used his older daughter. A couple of lines down. Laban has blinded Jacob to get what he wants. Jacob's mother had blinded Isaac by deception to get what she wanted. Turnabout is fair play. The deceiver has been deceived. And now, this whole sojourn, he's going to be there 14 years for two wives, an additional 6 years to gain his wealth. He'll be there in Paddan Aram, working with and around and under Uncle Laban for 20 years. And in that process, we would suggest that his faith is slowly beginning to develop. He goes to work. He works hard. He has no disputes until we get to the very end of their time together. Laban, at the top of page 102, is pictured as cunning, deceptive, heartless, greedy, and ambitious. And we're reminded of a New Testament principle, do not be deceived. God cannot be mocked. A man reaps what he sows. And Laban will reap a little later what he has sown. Okay, we beginning with chapter 29 and 31, into chapter 30, we have the married life to Leah and to Rachel. We have all of the children born to them and to their handmaidens that are given to them. If you'll look on the top of page 103, you'll notice we have a chart with the 12 tribes or sons of Israel or Jacob. You'll notice in the first column we have Leah, and she has the first four sons. I would like for you to notice that Reuben is not the seed of the woman, promised son, nor is Simeon, nor is Levi. Customarily, we would expect it start with the oldest and move down. They will disqualify themselves by their activity, which is described later in the book of Genesis. The seed of the woman, the messianic line, comes through son number four, and that is Judah. So Judah is of the messianic line, which is somewhat ironic. Who was the beloved wife? Rachel. But which wife will produce the messianic son? Leah. And so you see God graciously giving the despised woman the privilege of birthing the lineage of the Messiah. Now it came time. Jacob's had enough. Bottom of page 103, Genesis 30, verse 25. Rachel gives birth to Joseph. Jacob said to Laban, hey, send me on my way. Let me go. I have fulfilled everything that I promised you. Give me my wives and my children, and I'm out of town. But Laban said, look, oh, hey, we're family. Come on. If I've found any favor in your eyes, I've learned by divination that the Lord has blessed me because of you. So name your wages. Now we're back to this. We're bargaining again. I'm going to tell you, folks, don't ever buy a camel or a car from Laban. You will lose. Name your wages. Stay a while. Don't leave. The next page, top of the point one, the previous narrative has demonstrated how God provided descendants for Abram. Now we're going to see how he's going to provide blessings or material wealth. He's labored 14 years to get wives. He'll now labor 6 more years in order to get his own flocks and herds. And here's what they agreed to. And you can just see, I want you to just see Laban and Jacob, the two deceivers, trying to work each other over. And here's what Jacob comes up with. He says, we know that when sheep are birthed, that the vast majority look a certain way, a basic color. But there are a few speckled, mottled sheep. They're in the minority. And Jacob says, if you'll just give me those, give me the vast minority. You keep the vast majority. We'll let the birth of the animals determine which belongs to you, which belongs to me, and we'll separate our herds. There's no branding of the cattle. I mean, this is the best way to know. Hey, if it's mottled and speckled and so forth, it's mine. If it's not, then it's yours. And Laban is going, you know, about 80% of the sheep look like mine. About 20 will look like him. Yeah, I think I can do this deal. But then God intervenes. And contrary to nature, suddenly Jacob's sheep become more and more and more numerous, and what we would have expected become more and more few. And so he begins to get wealthy, and that is going to cause some problems. And in doing so, let's skip all the way over to page 105 at the bottom. Jacob is going to resolve to leave because it's beginning to be a little bit tense. 20 years have passed in Paddan Aram. And now Jacob's resolve to leave is going to be spurred on, one, by Laban's sons. At the top of page 106, notice the text. Genesis 31:1. Jacob heard that Laban's sons were saying, Jacob's taken everything. Now, come on. Your father had already said, I've been blessed because of you. You know, your presence here, God has blessed me because you've been in my presence, but not the sons. Oh, he's stealing our dad's stuff. I mean, before that, we were getting really, really wealthy, wealth upon wealth, but now it's not nearly as good as it used to be. He's taken everything that our father has owned. Second point beneath that passage, he's spurred on by his explanations to his wife. What Jacob did is he went to Rachel and Leah and he said, look, you know that I've worked hard for your father. And not only have I worked hard for him, you know also that God has blessed me in this and that I've not done anything wrong. He acknowledged God as the source of his blessings, and he also said, and by the way, I had a dream and God told me it was time to leave. Now, what are the wives going to do? We're not leaving our, no. Notice point three. The wives reply in 31:14. Then Rachel and Leah replied, do we have any share in the inheritance of our father's estate? He's abandoned us, ignored us. In fact, your 14 years of wages for us should have been given back to us. But it hasn't been given back to us. We have nothing. He regards us as foreigners. We're no better than slaves to him. Not only has he sold us, he's used up what was paid for us. Rachel and Leah are obviously angry with their father's treatment. They acknowledge God's decision for it's time for them to leave. And Rachel does something that nobody knows about. She steals Laban's household gods, or his idol. That household idol would have been placed in the home. It would be a small figurine placed in the home as a place of veneration, possibly even worship. But it also served as the whoever held the household idol held the deed to the inheritance. So she's saying, you cheated me out of my inheritance. I'll take your god, your household idol, which is evidence that I rightfully should have the inheritance rights, and I'm going to take it and steal it and take it with me. Maybe in a little bit of spite and a little bit of claim to what she felt like was hers. Chapter 31 at the top of 107, chapter 31, verse 22, Jacob leaves at night or leaves in a stealth sort of way. Laban and his sons are off busy at the time of shearing. When they find out that Jacob and his whole family has left, they chase them down, find them in Gilead. Very near the promised land. And God comes to Laban and in a dream says to him, be careful not to say anything to Jacob, either good or bad. In other words, you are not to exercise vengeance. You are not to do anything. You don't say anything good or bad. And so consequently, Laban then brings two accusations against Jacob. The first one was, why did you deceive me? You stole my daughters, and you stole my grandchildren. I'm a grandfather. That's the greater crime. You stole my children. You stole my granddaughters. What is this that you've deceived me? I've never been deceived like this in my life. This is a deceiver. This guy is a pro. And Laban with this is feigning all of this innocence, forgetting that he has been deceiving Jacob all along. Remember the Leah thing? All right, what have you deceived me? Why have you done this? And then he says, and by that, not only that, you took my household idol, my symbol of my inheritance, what belongs to me. And Jacob says, no, I didn't. And he says, you did. And Jacob says, then search throughout all of my goods, through my tents. You just search for it. And if you find it, the person who had it will be put to death. Now, he has no idea that Rachel has it, that she's hidden it away. And so, after Laban searches, he can't find it. And at the top of page 108, it says in Genesis 31:36, Jacob was angry, and he took Laban to task. 20 years of repressed frustration now comes pouring out as Jacob is the innocent party of this bold, serious accusation. Jacob demanded proof. His reputation's at stake, both back in Haran as well as among all of the people gathered around listening to this. Laban has no proof. And so what Laban, in effect, has to do is say, all right, then I don't have proof. You and I need a parity covenant, a covenant between and a contract between equals. We're going to set up a pillar, a stone, a marker, and I will not cross over that marker toward you. You will not cross over that marker according to me. This is not a friendly agreement. This is an agreement saying we're building a wall between us. And don't you come back anymore, and I won't come see you. It's over. And that's precisely what they did. And as we go to the top of page 109, Jacob has now freed himself from Uncle Laban and his deceptive tricks. But his greatest challenge is to face his brother, who 20 years earlier was planning to kill him. And so now with chapter 32, we have the reunion with Esau. Now, an individual like Jacob can try to run from his past, but a day of reckoning always comes. Be sure your sin will find you out. Jacob needs two things. One, he needs a great reassurance of God's presence. God is still with him. And he also needs the ability to face the uncertainty of an angry brother. And this is going to require brokenness. You see, Jacob has been the arrogant deceiver. He now needs to be the humble, broken servant. His faith needs to move from wavering infancy to much more bolder, stronger. For he must be the patriarchal head of the family. And so consequently, we're reminded of Psalm 51:17, a psalm after David's sin with Bathsheba, in which David says, "The sacrifices of God are a broken spirit, a broken and contrite heart, O God, you will not despise." And that is what Jacob needs, and it's what Jacob lacks, brokenness. And brokenness is on the horizon, by the way. Chapter 32, verse 1, Jacob went on his way, and the angels of God met him at a place he calls Mahanaim. There are three encounters that Jacob has with angels. At Bethel, on his way to Paddan Aram. At Mahanaim, on his way back from Paddan Aram. And then at Peniel, where he will wrestle with the angel. Jacob needs and must have a life-change experience. His faith in God must be based not upon heredity, but upon personal experiential faith. That is true. That was true then. That is true now as well. Everyone needs their personal faith, not the faith of your parents, not the faith of your grandparents, not the faith of your heritage or your ancestors. Everyone needs their own personal, vibrant faith. As we turn the page, we pick up the story in chapter 32, verse 3. Jacob sends messengers ahead to his brother. He instructed them to say and call his brother, "My Lord Esau." Jacob refers to himself, "Your servant." Already we see a humility that he did not have when they were living together 20 years earlier. This is the language of diplomatic courtesy, but it also indicates the growing humility of Jacob before his brother Esau. He prudently sends messengers to his brother. He refers to himself as "your servant," addresses his brother as "master." The arrogance of Jacob's past must be righted. Chapter 32, verse 6, at the bottom of 110, when the messengers returned to Jacob, they said, "We went to your brother Esau." That's the good news. "And he's coming to meet you with 400 men." That's the bad news. Because if it was just a welcoming party, you take a dozen or 15. If you're bringing 400 men, if you'll remember when Abraham went chasing after the kings who took less than 400 men, soldiers. So he's bringing an army with him. And I think at that moment, the knees of Jacob buckled. And so, is this a reunion for war or royal reception? Jacob doesn't appear to know, but I think he leans towards war. And so, his emotional response is great fear and distress. And at the top of the next page, page 111, the second scripture verse, it says, what does Jacob do? Then Jacob prayed. It's come to this. Is there nothing else that I can do? Can I not manipulate in some other way? Is there no one else I can deceive? My brother's coming to meet me with 400 soldiers. Where do I turn now? Well, it's come to this. I have to pray. And this is the first recorded prayer of Jacob. It is an evidence of his growing faith and perhaps his brokenness. I have a chart for you that sort of captures that prayer of Genesis 32. Five components. He acknowledged who God is, the God of his father Abraham, God of his father Isaac. He acknowledged who he was. I'm unworthy. Literally, I'm too small. He acknowledges what he needs. Save me. Deliver me. The deceiver trickster has no human means for deliverance from his brother Esau. He's at the end of his deceptive rope. What I feel, I'm afraid. And what you said, God, you told me. He appeals to the promise of God. You told me. Remember your promises that you made to me. He's desperate, and only God is his answer. All right, the next page. We'll pick up the story at the middle of page 112, and that is when, once Jacob separates himself from his troop, his company of people, wives and children and flocks and herds and servants and so forth, Jacob goes out, and he's alone near the brook of Jabbok. And in verse 24, it says, "So Jacob was left alone. And a man wrestled with him till daybreak." Who's that man? Hosea, referring to this event, calls the man an angel. If in fact it was an angel, as Scripture acknowledges, I would suggest it was the angel of the Lord, which in my theology, the angel of the Lord is the pre-incarnate, before Bethlehem appearance of Jesus the Christ, or the Son of God, if you will, more accurately. He is now going to have to be, he's alone, he has prayed to God, and he's now alone. He has no devices, he has no deception, he is alone, and now he has to wrestle with the one person he cannot deceive and he cannot defeat. And God's going to wrestle with him and wrestle with him and wrestle with him. And the outcome's not in doubt, because every minute, every hour that they wrestle brings Jacob closer and closer to the point of knowing who he is, such that the man, the angel of the Lord, will say to him, "What's your name?" "My name's Deceiver." "Not anymore. Your name now is," he has striven with God, prevailed with God in prayer, is the idea. The divine wrestler touches the socket of his hip, and Jacob, for the rest of his life, will walk with a limp. He'll never be the same again. He'll not be the same emotionally. He'll not be the same intellectually. He will not be the same spiritually. He will not be the same physically. He will now walk with a limp. Jacob, point D in the middle of page 113. Jacob the deceiver now becomes Israel, striver, or prevailer. It marks a change in the man. Not full, not complete. He's got a ways to go yet. But it is a new direction by a new man who has a new name. So Jacob called that place Peniel, which means the face of God. Why? I saw God face to face, yet my life was spared. Do you think he has any doubt as to who he just wrestled with? None whatsoever. And he was limping because of his hip. Chapter 33, Jacob looks up and there's Esau coming with 400 men. So he divides his party. Verse 3, he goes on ahead and bows down to the ground seven times. Symbolic action of total submission to his brother. Point B at the top of 14. Jacob's prostration shows the submissiveness of an inferior before a superior. Verse 4 tells us how Jacob's going to handle this. Esau will handle this. But Esau ran to meet Jacob. At best, Jacob limps to meet Esau. Esau ran to meet Jacob, embraced him, threw his arms around his neck, and kissed him, and together they wept. What could have been the end of his life is now the restoration with his brother. Esau runs, Jacob limps, and they meet together. Jacob's a new man. Esau's heart of revenge has melted. Jacob gives him a portion of his material blessings, a way of saying by Esau's reception of it that there's nothing more that needs to be done. Esau's satisfied. All previous wrongs have been righted, and now they're okay with one another. Esau says, "Come up to Seir, out in the wilderness area, and live with us." And Jacob says, no, I'm going to travel with my group. And in fact, they cross over the Jordan River into the promised land that had been promised to him by Abrahamic covenant promise. And he will settle, first of all, in Shechem for a while, and then he will go back to Bethel, where he should have gone the first time. We don't have time to go through the tragedy with Dinah in Shechem. But while he's in Shechem, he's going to be prosperous, but he is not going to grow spiritually. He's got to get back to Bethel, and on page 116 in the middle of the page, that's where we're ready to go. After a number of years, Genesis 35:1, then God said to Jacob, go up to Bethel, settle there. These are imperatives, by the way. In fact, that word go in the NIV really is arise, that's an imperative, and go, that's an imperative. Settle, that's an imperative. Build an altar, that's an imperative. All these things you promised me in your vision, in our vision dream, on your way to Paddan Aram, you have not fulfilled. And years have passed. So God commands him to fulfill his earlier vow. God commands that an altar be built. And on the top of page 117, Jacob then commands his family, saying, this is a fresh start. And here's the command for us. Number one, family, get rid of the foreign gods. We're going to have a rededication and a spiritual renewal as a family unit. Secondly, purify yourselves. Consecrate yourself. Find your ceremonial purity to enter the presence of the Lord. Thirdly, change your clothes as a sign of your purification. Verse chapter 35, and God said to him, I'm God Almighty. And then what does he do? He reassures him with all of those Abrahamic covenant blessing aspects. And they're listed out. Nations, kings, descendants, land, blessing is implied. All of those things are going to be yours. Also at the end of that chapter, Rachel will die giving birth to Benjamin. Deborah, Rebecca's nurse, will also die and be buried near Bethel. And then we'll have a listing of the sons of Israel. The last page will not cover it. It's simply the Toledot of Esau. It's actually two Toledotes in one chapter. But we call it one Toledot. Of whatever happened to Esau and his descendants, it's a very brief treatment, and I'll let you read it. What do we learn from this? Here's our walk away today. Like Jacob, everyone is on a faith journey. It begins and your faith is weak and needs to be awakened, and it needs to begin growing. But along the way, your faith must develop in order that you can, at the end of your life, be the mature person that you were always intended to be. We follow Jacob, and we see that sometimes he has to have moments of weakness in order to learn that he'd prefer to have moments of spiritual strength, not weakness. And through his failures, he's learning that there is a better way, such that he has to finally come to the place where he's alone, and he has to struggle and wrestle with God, and he's never the same man again. I'm not saying he's perfect. He's still Jacob. But he is now a different person with a different name, and he is becoming the patriarchal figure that will be the father of the 12 tribes of Israel. Maybe the walkaway challenge for us is a searching question. Am I growing and developing in my faith? And have I had that personal encounter with God that completely redefines the path and the choice I'm going to take? I may have been a Christian beforehand, but have I had my Romans 12 moment that I placed myself on the altar of God and said, God, use me in any way you wish. Take me any place you want me to go. I'm not going to be transformed by the world and all that the world offers, but I'm going to be transformed by the renewing of my mind. I'm going to place biblical truths in my mind, and God, my life is on the altar. Everyone needs a come to Jesus moment. And if you haven't had one, you need it. And if you've had one and you've walked away from it, you need to go back to the altar. One of my professors used to say, the problem with living sacrifices is once they place themselves on the altar, sometimes they crawl off. And I've done that a time or two. God, may this be a day where we would desire and then take our desire and make it action to walk closely with you is our prayer in the name of Christ. Amen. God bless you. Thank you for coming. Next week, Joseph.